Hi, good morning, everybody. Have we got any questions? Well, I'm hoping to circulate the first practical assignment sometime this afternoon. I'm sort of waiting for comments to come back from the people who are reviewing it. If everything goes okay, then we'll circulate it. Otherwise, maybe it'll be Monday or something after we make some changes. You'll have to do your coursework in teams. Find yourself a partner, let me know. Otherwise, I'll help you find a partner. Ultimately, you'll get assigned a partner. Some people have sent me the names of their partners in already. Still no questions? Even after I said something scary there? Okay. Right, well, it's a good thing all you guys are here this morning, because the practical assignment's going to use some of the material that we're going to cover in the first few minutes. In fact, probably almost all of today will be potentially usable for your practical assignment. So here we've got two colored images. You can think of them as consecutive images in a video sequence or sort of time-lapse photography or something like that. We want to detect the changes. So here's our before image, here's our after image, and you can see there's obviously a big something or other that suddenly appeared in the scene. And, well, we could do this quite easily in MATLAB. If we have a color image called before and a color image called after, well, we could subtract the two images. Okay, this does a pixel by pixel subtraction. Wherever there's a difference, it subtracts the red from the red, the green from the green, the blue from the blue. Gives you a three-dimensional image out. Okay, we could apply the absolute value operator to that. So that does an absolute value on each of the individual color plane differences. So it's the absolute value of the red after minus red before. Okay, it does it at every pixel at every color plane. This is useful because the new pixel might be, let's say, brighter than what there was before, or it might potentially be darker than what there was before. And so the absolute value allows it to change either way, either brighter or darker. And I wrote a little thresholding function that says, okay, here's the threshold value of anything from this result, this image right here, which is less than 35. I consider that to be an insignificant change. Anything bigger than that is a significant change. That gives me an image. You'll see some examples in a minute. I wrote a little function called colorOr, which ors all the three individual planes together. At this point, it's just a binary, three binary images, all in the red, green, and blue planes. I ored them all together. That combines the evidence from all three of the different color planes. And finally, I used an operator called open with effectively a two-pixel parameter. And what open does is it gets rid of small isolated noise points that might have arisen because of the thresholding or the color image. So this one, we're not going to really talk about these morphology operations in this class. We'll talk a little bit about them in the advanced vision class. But you might want to just sort of look it up on sort of MATLAB or Wikipedia or something like that, or the Hyper page or whatever. They all have a little article on open. Okay, so, and I'll just make a little throwaway comment. Here, all of the images that have been loaded in are in a red, green, blue coding system for color. And there's about a dozen different coding systems for color. Another one of which is HSI, hue, saturation, and intensity. And there's no real difference in the, let's say, the overall information that's represented in these different coding systems. It's just they've encoded it in a different kind of way. And sometimes that alternative coding makes certain other properties explicit. So the HSI tends to pick out the dominant color in the hue plane. The saturation sort of says how bright or dark that color, well, let's see, how much true color and how much whiteness is in that. So that's the saturation. And the intensity is the overall brightness or darkness of the image. Okay, so that's an alternative way of coding color, and there's about a dozen different ways that one can encode colors. But for the all the stuff that we're going to do here, we're just going to use RGB.
Sorry, when it says to cope with illumination changes, does that mean so that we more easily ignore illumination changes?
That's right. So therefore, you would do your processing on the H and S channels potentially. Well, you use them for different reasons, whatever. But if you're in a scene where, like, maybe you're outdoors and the lighting is changing all the time, okay, then the I component is going to change a lot. But the H and S, if your camera is stationary, you're looking at the same stuff all the time. The color of the same stuff is always the same. It's just that the amount of light that comes off is varying in intensity because of the variation in the illumination on it. Good question. Okay. But here we're only going to use the RGB. So here's an example of when I do that kind of up to sort of about here. Okay, this is what you get for the red plane, and this is what you get for the green plane. And you can see that they both sort of picked out sort of large changes related to that new object that's in the scene. Here is the ORing of them two together. Okay, so there's a pixel-wise OR. If there's a white pixel in either of these two images, or in the blue one, which I didn't show you here, then the output gives you a 1 if there's a, if it's detected in one of the three different planes. And the reason why you might do this is if, this was a red background or whatever, and I walked in front of it with a red shirt or whatever, okay, you may not see me, but maybe it's, instead of a red shirt, it's maybe a brown shirt or something like that. Well, there's a large component of red in the brown. The red plane may not pick up the difference, but maybe the blue plane would, something like that. So you use all the different kinds of color evidence there. If you look at this image right here, you notice there's lots of little dots around here. And that's just related to maybe a little bit of jitter in the camera, maybe a little flicker in the lighting, something like that, maybe just a bit of noise. Usually it happens around the edges of objects. And if you do this opening technique, effectively what open does is it dilates all of the white by 2 pixels. The argument was 2. In that particular function. So it shrinks in all the white by 2, okay, which is going to cause lots of these little small things to disappear. And then after it shrinks in 2, it then expands by 2 backwards. Okay, that's what the open can be defined in terms of. And the net result is that a lot of the small stuff disappears, but when you've expanded it back out, it's kind of tends to come out pretty much back to the same shape it was for the big structures. There's a corresponding function called close, which expands everything and then shrinks it backwards. And that's useful for sort of filling in little holes in the middle of these objects and these little gaps along the edges and things like that, if you wanted. But I didn't feel it was necessary here. Okay, so that's one technique that's related to what you've done before for detecting changes. It's like the binary, except for here we do it in color planes. Okay, well, I suggested that that could be used for like video where you're looking at consecutive images. But for a lot of cameras, you have complicated images, but you have the advantage of having a static background image. Okay, so, and that will be the case for your practicals here. You're going to have a background image which you can capture in advance. Okay, and anytime you get a new image, instead of just doing some sort of thresholding on that new image like we did with the dark part on the light background, there we were exploiting knowledge of the scene. Here we're going to exploit knowledge of the background. What we do is we can subtract the background from the image and then threshold that. So that's a bit like the one example that we just saw a minute ago. Okay, and again, we've got the absolute value signs around here because the new image, the structure in the new image could be either lighter or darker than the background. And then we do our thresholding just like we do normally. And as in the previous example, if we've got 3 different color planes, okay, well, we can do this thresholding on the red plane. It should have subscript G and subscript B right there for the red, green, and blue planes. Okay, so you do it on the red, the green, and the blue planes, and then you OR them all together, just like in the last example. Okay, well, this will deal with something like a problem with the many objects, because you have a background that has many objects in it as well, and you're doing a pixel-wise subtraction of it, so it doesn't really matter generally how much stuff you have in the background. Here's here's an example of that. Okay, so here we have our fixed background object. Here we have a new person who sort of jumped into the scene, and when you apply the algorithm that I just kind of sketched out in the previous slide, you get something like this. It's made it pretty clear where the person is. You can see it's not perfect. There's this gap missing right here. Well, that's because the shirt is essentially the same color as the background. If you're doing background differencing, there's no difference, and so you don't see it. Yeah.
So just to clarify, the image that you're referring to is once we've taken the object out of this picture,
yeah.
That is defined as the image.
That's defined as the background image. So
the
you're
object that we take out. So the person in that picture that we took out.
This one here? Well, I think that would, you might call that the detected object, an image of the detected object or something. So here, this background image is just some image that you took in advance. The foreground is the current image. So your video is, watching, people going back and forth. For example, at the moment, when they're doing the video recording of the lectures, by the way, this lecture is being video recorded. If you go to the IVR page, there's a link to where all the videos are from the lectures here. They've got a pan tilt camera there in the back, and at the moment it's all set up for a fixed camera position. The pan tilt head doesn't move back and forth, as I move around. But for example, you could use this kind of technique to detect me and have the camera track me, because it is a fixed background. There's nothing changing back there. It's just effectively me moving around in front of it. Okay, so you can detect where I am and then sort of steer the camera so it's pointing at the center of this detected region right there. Okay, so you can, track me. And there's lots of tracking systems that do essentially that. Okay, there's also, notice there's a little bit of an edge right around here. That could be because there was slight jitter in the camera. It could be that my handy-dandy lab assistant bumped into the chair just slightly as he was stepping into the scene, or maybe air currents moved it around a little bit anyway. So anyway, there's a slight difference in here. What one often does is use this opening technique again. That would get rid of this and all this little kind of jitter around here. All this little stuff around here is probably due to the shadow that was created when he stepped into the scene. And that's a common problem with this background differencing technique. The technique assumes that the background is stationary, but of course, as soon as you have light changes in lighting, while the structure is the same, the color and the appearance is different due to this lighting. Okay, which leads us on to the next technique. And so we used the RGB pixels right there, just sort of raw pixels. Now there's another technique that's a slight adaptation of it that's called the normalized RGB. Okay, and instead of using the RGB as they are, you take the RGB and you divide by the sum of the three. Okay, and this is normalized to illumination. And just to give you an example, okay, so here's a case of where I've doubled the illumination. Okay, so all the original R values are now 2R. I've doubled the amount of light in. That means the amount of light that comes off is doubled. To a first order approximation inside the camera, that means you've got doubled, all your quantization numbers go up by a factor of 2. Okay, and when I plug all my doubled numbers into the normalization formula, it gives you exactly the same thing as the original numbers. So the representation is independent of the scaling right here, so the illumination. Yep. Yeah, okay, so the question is it really correct to add all the numbers just sort of in a naive form? And you raised a good point about that. Another point I was going to make is that actually cameras are not linear. When you double the amount of light on the scene, it doesn't double the quantization values. Okay, they do that. And so this is not an ideal, you know, it's not a perfectly correct technique. If you're really doing careful camera engineering, you would take all of that into account. But for the sake of this particular class, we're just going to use kind of the basic technique, and that's what this is. And this is called normalized RGB, and that's what this is the way everyone does it. Yeah. No, you're absolutely right. Now, one thing to kind of note about this is originally we've got a three-dimensional representation. When we do this dividing by the average, actually we've got three numbers, but you can calculate any one of them from the other two because the sum of these normalized components equals one. And so what many people do is after they do this normalization, they do all subsequent processing with just the R normalized R component and the normalized G component, and they throw away the B one because that could be just recalculated from the other two. And there's another bit more subtle reason why they use just the R and the G, and that is because most color cameras use more bits to encode the red and green components than they do the blue component. And so actually, the quantization and encoding accuracy is better with the R and G normalized components. And that's partly for an engineering reason. When they have a little block of color, they do a 4x2 pixel block of color. You get three red, three green, and two blue pixels in that little block on the chip. Okay, so there's one less pixel for the blue. That gives you less color resolution. And why that engineering choice is a good engineering choice has to do with the human and primate retina. The development of the blue cone, you have in the back of your retina, you have these rods that measure lightness, sort of effectively black and white or grayscales. You also have three kinds of cone cells that measure the color. They used to be called sort of red, green, and blue, but now that they have more precise measurements, they're not really red, green, and blue. They're sort of, they call them long, short, long, and medium wavelength. But for the sake of clarity, or let's say approximation for a clearer explanation, we'll call them red, green, blue here just for a minute. The evolution of these color systems didn't produce all three of these cones all at the same time. The red one appeared first, and then the green one, and then the blue cone is a pretty recent evolutionary development. And if you look at electron micrographs of the retina, you'll discover that the blue cones are very small, and they're much more sparse than the red and green cones, which are pretty much equal. And consequently, the human's ability to perceive blue is considerably less sensitive than that of red and green. So we don't perceive blue very well, therefore the camera and television monitor people optimize their devices by putting more effort into the red and green at the expense of the blue. And finally, so when we get down to the machine and computer vision, all of the devices that we tend to use are based on these sort of commercial things optimized for human consumption. And so we have to kind of put up with what we get, and that is a blue channel, which is less sensitive than the red and green channels. So that's a long, elaborate explanation, but maybe you find it interesting as well. I didn't see anyone fall asleep, so it can't be that bad. Okay, so here's an example of the normalized RGB. So here's an original image, and you can see there's sort of a white piece of paper in here with shadow on. So there's a light side and a dark side. Here are three nicely colored objects, and here are those same objects in the shadow. And after I've done this sort of normalizing effect, you'll notice that the white paper all now has a constant color. That's because it's normalized away the illumination, which is the only difference between this bright bit and this dark bit. And you'll notice also that the three colored objects all now have pretty much the same brightness levels between the light version and the dark version. And that's because they are the same colors, just have different amounts of lightness. So the normalization technique that we've used here actually has been reasonably effective in compensating for the variation in illumination. And if there was a large illumination contrast, like much brighter up here and much darker down here, even with no shadows or something like that, the same normalization would still be of value. You might find it interesting that your first practical assignment is going to use lots of these little objects in it, colored objects. So you may find this normalization technique here quite useful for your practical assignment. Okay. Anybody want to ask any questions right now? Yeah. Yeah, I was wondering that myself, and I don't have an answer for it. So, well, one possible explanation, which I haven't done any experimental checking on, is it may be there's lots of other objects around in the scene, and you get reflected light off of these other objects. And so it may be some of that reflected light has a slight greenish tint to it. Okay, so this is, I'm just making up a possible explanation here without any evidence for it. Okay, so it may have a greenish tint. Our eyes actually don't see a lot of these things because we have a really sophisticated color compensation mechanism that nobody really understands yet. And so there may be a slight greenish tint right here, and then when you do that normalizing, that greenish tint is the color that gets normalized, you know, into sort of full-blown version of it. So that might be an explanation for it. I don't know. Or any other questions? Yeah.
Just looking at some of these movies, I think in the practical so far, we've been capturing images as JPEG.
Yeah.
Is there any way of capturing them as raw bitmaps instead so that we'd avoid some of these effects and just quantization and so on?
Well, I think a lot depends on how, okay, so the question is right now we're getting these JPEGs and there's a certain amount of compression and color coding and all that sort of stuff that goes on with it, and the question is, can you get raw images out where you've effectively got, you know, sort of raw 8-bit measurements of the individual colors, for example. And I think the answer to that depends on the tools that you're using. So you need, for example, more sophisticated cameras that allow you access to the individual RGB elements. At the moment, we're using a webcam, which I think does the compression on the chip and sends the compressed version up the USB. So it's already kind of built in there. Some webcams allow you to download some parameters to set the webcams. More intelligent and more expensive cameras certainly do, because you want to be able to control all that. But I think we're kind of just stuck with it here for the lab practicals. But actually, they've been optimized to work pretty well. So I'm not ever worried about that, at least for our lab practicals. All right. Okay. Well, what we're working up to is to try and recognize these sorts of parts right here. And we've done pretty much all of the image processing we're going to do, where we're working with the images themselves. And we've developed several techniques for detecting the objects and thresholding and going to, you know, group the pixels together to find the object itself. And now we want to start looking at the recognition bit. So there's going to need to be two things we're going to need to do here. One is we're going to have to somehow make a set of descriptive properties about this object, because it's, at the moment it's about 100,000 pixels. We can't work with 100,000 pixels. We're going to have to group them together and somehow say something about that group of pixels. So the first thing we're going to do is we're going to look at a way of describing the objects in the scene. And the second thing we're going to do is look at a way to take those descriptions and use those descriptions for our recognition purposes. Okay, so we're going to look at some techniques for describing this image in the rest of this particular lecture, and then we'll get on to the recognition algorithms. Okay, well, there's a lot of problems. One is that we need to have a good set of vocabularies. Okay, for parts like this, we could talk about edges and corners and things like that. That actually worked pretty well, good sort of geometric descriptions. But edges and corners don't work for everything. For example, like human faces, you need a kind of more subtle kind of description. Okay, and it's also difficult to get descriptions that sort of are somewhat independent of all of these different things that can cause you troubles. I mean, you would like to have a description for, in the case of these simple parts that we're looking at, that's independent of the position of the part in the image. You don't want to have two different descriptions depending on whether the part's in the upper left or the lower right, or alternatively, if it rotates by 10 degrees. You know, okay, yes, the appearance has changed, but you don't want to have the description change. So we're going to look for properties that give us this kind of invariance that we need to be able to easily recognize our objects. Okay, so, and what we're going to use here is just a property-based description. Okay, so for example, the area of this part right here, this area right here is one of the properties of that object. It's not entirely ideal because if you move the camera back, the object looks smaller, the area changes or whatever. But on the other hand, it does pretty much summarize, you know, the content of all those pixels, and it is position and rotation independent. You could sort of move it, you know, the object up the upper left-hand corner, or I could rotate it 10 degrees and the area will still remain the same. So it does have some value. Okay. It's also a bit ambiguous because you can get lots of different shapes, all of which have exactly the same area. Okay, so we're going to say, well, we're not going to just depend on a single property. So what I'm going to do kind of for the next, the rest of today really is just to give you a set of different properties that one might use for different kinds of projects. So you might use some of them in the practical assignment, for example. Some, but not all. Okay, so I said area was one example. We can calculate the area in MATLAB quite easily. MATLAB has, here's our binary image. Okay, binary is zero, it's all 0, 1 values. Okay, and assuming that the desired object is a 1 pixel, that's the sort of the white pixels in these binary images. Sometimes you have to invert the MATLAB as an invert command that sort of changes the 1s to 0s and the 0s to 1s. Anyway, but for here, here's our binary image and our object is 1. MATLAB has a built-in command called BWArea, black and white area, okay, that counts up all the pixels. It also has a perimeter command that goes through and finds all the pixels that belong on the perimeter. So this is takes an image as an input, gives an image as an output, but the only pixels that are marked in the output image are pixels which are on the boundary of the object. Okay, so that doesn't give us the length of the perimeter. But when we do this area, it does give us the length. That gives us the total number of pixels that were on the boundaries, which is a kind of approximation of the perimeter. There's this little argument here, 4. That says, well, when I calculate the perimeter, do I use 4 connectivity, sort of going horizontally or vertically? The other argument you could put in there is 8, which allows sort of diagonal connectivity as well. And you get slight different variations in the number of pixels that are selected as lying on the perimeter, depending on whether you use the 4 connectivity or 8 connectivity. Okay, so these are pretty robust to noise. If I, you know, added a little bit of noise to the image and then thresholded it, okay, the boundary would change a little bit. That means the area is going to change just a little bit and the perimeter will change a little bit, but not hugely right here. It's independent of translation and orientation. You know, if I move it around the image, the shape of the part is still the same, the area is the same, the number of pixels on the perimeter is the same. But it's not independent of scale or zoom. If I move my camera twice as far away, all the objects in the image are going to be half the size. Okay, the area is going to go down by a factor of 4, the perimeter goes down by a factor of 2. Here's some properties which are invariant to position and scale. Okay, so that means I can zoom the image. Okay, the first one is called compactness. Okay, it's has the form perimeter squared over area. If I move my camera twice as far away, my area goes down by a factor of 4, the perimeter goes down by a factor of 2, but when I square it, now it's down, goes down by a factor of 4, the perimeter squared goes down by a factor 4, so the ratio of the two don't change. And then there's a little scaling factor right here so that the minimum value is always 1.0, You can omit that if you want. And anyway, the minimum is for a perfectly compact object, which is a circle. Here's a set of topological properties. This is the counts of various things. They don't change as you move the object around, as you rotate, translate, scale, or whatever. They all remain the same. Some relative properties that also are invariant to both the position and scale. So the average angle between consecutive line segments. So back to our part right here, if I have this line segment and that line segment, there's a 90 degree angle between them. And that 90 degree stays the same no matter where in the image it is, whatever rotation, whatever zoom, it's still invariant. So those are all very useful properties. And they're all sort of single ones. MATLAB has his BW area built in and BW param. You can also find on the web page, there's another version, I think it's called My BW Area and My BW Param. The reason for that is that these commands are in the MATLAB image processing toolbox. And at least they used to be. Maybe they moved them into the main toolbox now. The university has to pay separate licenses for each of these toolboxes, so they haven't bought too many of them. They've got several hundred general licenses, but they only have like 10 of the image processing toolbox licenses. So if you, there's 110 of you here, if you're all trying to use this command at the same time, it's going to just say the toolbox is not available. Consequently, we put some of the more common ones on the course webpage that you can use, and you can also sort of search the web and get copies of some of these things as well, so you can run them independently of the toolboxes. Right, so those are some of the simple properties. And now I'm going to introduce a whole collection of properties all in the same sort of family. The family is called moments or moments of inertia, kind of inspired by physics and then adapted to image analysis here. Okay, and there's a whole family, there's an infinite number of these. So that gives you lots of different properties. One of the things that's going to be interesting is that you can make them invariant to translation, rotation, and scaling. And we'll see how to do that. Okay, and what that means is that gives us a set of numbers that'll be very useful for this recognition purpose. The infinite families generally are not in all necessarily invariant to the translation, rotation, and scaling. You make an infinite family, it's invariant to translation and scaling, but they're not invariant to rotation. Okay, and we have to do yet one further technique to make them invariant to rotation. But we'll do all that in just probably in the rest of today, I think. Okay, so here's our image. Okay, it's a binary image indexed by row and column. The 1 pixels correspond to the object, and the 0 pixels are the background. So the first thing we can do, which we'll need anyway, is the area. So this is just a count over all the rows and columns of all of the pixels. Only the 1 pixels have, or only the object pixels have the value 1, all the rest are value 0. So you're just counting the number of pixels that are object pixels. That's straightforward. Okay, the second one is what's called the center of mass. It's a kind of measure of the centralness. Find a pixel that's somewhere near the center of the object. Those of you done sort of high school physics or first year university physics will have encountered this kind of center of mass definition for the physical center of mass of an object. Here we're doing it in an image processing kind of context. It's again just summed over all the pixels, but it's the row position times whether it's on the object or not. Effectively, it's the average of all the row positions of all the pixels in the object and the average of all the column positions of all the pixels in the object. Okay, so that gives us our center of mass. When you use this, you have to be a little bit careful right here because we're dividing by this number right here. Almost certainly these will be floating point numbers that are not exact integers, so you have to do some rounding or something like that to get integers if you want to draw the center of the mass in the image or index into a pixel. Okay, so these are just pretty much the preliminaries. Okay, and now we get on to the moments themselves. So I'm going to sort of skip the most elementary moment and go to the most first most useful thing that we've got here, and what's called a central moment. Okay, and these are all translation invariant. Okay, and they're just defined by this formula. There's an infinite number of these for all possible values of u and v. Okay, and there's this moment calculation. So for a given value of u and a given value of v, we can calculate a moment of this that describes this object in our current image. And the way we do that is we've got this sort of row generating term here, we've got this column generating term, and then we select the pixels that belong to the object. Okay, so this R and hat and C hat are these center of mass right here, and the R is the current position, sort of from the sum. Okay, so the moment definition just involves the, you know, the power of the row, power of the column, and which pixels count. Where we get the central bit, it corresponds to this translation invariance. Okay, and we get that by this, the fact that we've subtracted off the center of mass. The explanation for why that works is can easily seen. You know, if here's my object, here's my center of mass. Okay, if I move, and I want to have a pixel here relative to the center of mass, so a pixel here on the edge relative to the center of mass. If I move my object over here, well, okay, the pixel I'm interested in has moved, but so has the center of mass. And when we subtract the two, that distance between the two is the same whether it's over here or it's over here. And that's exactly what we're doing right here, is we're subtracting that center of mass to make that distance be invariant to the position of the object in the image. If the object is over here, the center of mass moves as well as the object itself. Okay, so that gives us an infinite set of numbers, which is translation invariant. Now, we're not going to use all infinite of them. Mostly people just use small values of this, sort of u goes sort of 0, 1, 2, 3, something like that, and similarly for v. One doesn't need to use positive integers. One doesn't need to use integers at all. But mostly what people use are small integer values. Okay, so that gives us an infinite set of moments that is invariant to the position in the image. Now, it's not invariant to scale yet, and nor is it invariant to rotation. So we're going to do two more steps to get to that. Sorry, I made that point already. Okay, well, imagine we've got an object in the image in one image, and we got an object in the next image where the object is sort of half the distance. Okay, so now that means the object is going to look twice as big, because the way optics works, sort of proportional to distance. If I'm half the distance to you, the object's going to look twice as big in the image. Okay, so if we do, if the object looks twice as big, then our moment calculations are going to go up by the twice to the power of u and twice to the power of v, because we've got this sort of r to the u and r to the v terms right in there. Okay, and similarly, we're also counting the pixels because we got the sum. Okay, and now since we're half the distance, the object's twice as big, there's now going to be four times as many pixels. The area of the object is going to be four times bigger. Okay, so as well as these terms increasing, we've also got four times as many pixels. Okay, so so that this, when we sort of half the distance, this thing is going to get a lot bigger by 4 times 2 to the u times 2 to the v. That number will get bigger. Okay, and similarly, the area is going to get increased by 4. And then the next bit is a little bit of a trick. It's an observation that people, you know, sort of the mathematicians made. Okay, and it's convenient. Okay, and that is that this area gets bigger, but if you took the area to this particular power, then this formula is also going to increase by this amount as well. Okay, so the moments are going to increase by 4 times 2 to the u times 2 to the v, and this particular formula also increases by that same amount. Okay, and with that observation, when you look at the ratio of the two, okay, that's this number which goes up and this other number which similarly goes up, when you look at the ratio of the two, then you get a kind of normalization that's invariant to scale. So this is just like that color normalization that I did, except for here this is an area type normalization, okay, or a moment normalization. So this is going to give us an infinite family of numbers, which is invariant translation, because area is invariant to translation, and these moments are invariant to translation. And also by looking at the ratio, these numbers, because it's a ratio of these things, is also invariant to scale. So all these, we have an infinite family of numbers which are invariant to translation and to scale. Okay, so that's a bit of a hurried sort of explanation. Any questions here for the moment? Yeah. Sorry.
How is this actually called in the literature if you want to look for a demonstration of?
Okay, so how would you, where would you look for a reference on this, for example? Okay, well, Wikipedia on moments, if you just type in moment or moments into Wikipedia would probably give it. If you look at CV Online, there's moments, there's a page on moments. At the moment, at this current time, it potentially is pointing to the Wikipedia page. That's an interesting little side. Do I have a minute for a little aside? Yeah, I have a minute for a little aside. So CV Online is a sort of hand-constructed encyclopedia of computer vision that I've been responsible for leading the development over the last sort of 10 or 12 years or something like that. And this was started kind of in the early days of the web, and it was a resource that's well used. Wikipedia didn't exist. Now Wikipedia is starting to get a lot of computer vision content on it. It covers about half the content that's in CV Online. And I figured maybe now we could shift to doing a community effort on developing, you know, this sort of resource. So I had somebody help me put a lot of the structure of CV Online into Wikipedia so that people could work with that structure and develop the structure. Well, Wikipedia is allegedly a user community managed sort of thing, but some users are more powerful than others, and they are self-claimed editors or something like that. So at the moment, we're kind of going through a long discussion. The Wikipedia people don't like lists, hierarchical structured lists that index all the knowledge. They like a perfectly flat sort of thing that a search engine can find. And they are of the opinion that all of the stuff that we just spent a few thousand pounds of labor to put into Wikipedia, they think all of that should go. So I'm having some discussions about them, whether they are right or wrong, or narrow-minded bastards. Sorry. Anyway. So we may revert to the former form of Wikipedia. Not Wikipedia, CV Online, which has a lot of pointers into Wikipedia, but none of the useful structuring of knowledge that we've also developed as well. So we shall see. Anyway, okay, back to the point. Any other questions here? Yeah.
Can you just give like an application, like a common application of moments?
Could I give an application of moments? I will on Friday, next Tuesday. So I'm kind of developing the use of the moments right now, but we'll use them for the object recognition. That'll be one of our kind of key sets, useful pieces of information. Actually, maybe at the very last bit of, if we get to the last bit today, no, actually I don't think we will, but the last bit of this lecture note shows you why they're useful. Okay. But the short answer is they're just a number, but they're a useful number which describes the object independent of its position, translation, rotation, scale, and stuff like that. And so it's a useful descriptor of the objects that we want. Okay, the last bit is a set of rotation invariant moments. And so I'm not really going to go through the full theory of the development. But basically, they have developed a way of kind of sort of set of complex moments which are invariant to rotation. And the sort of the infinite family sort of starts off with, instead of using the invariant moments that we had previously, they introduce a kind of complex number in here, okay, with the I and the sort of slight difference between the U and V components based on this complex number. They've sort of set up the initial number in just the same. You can still see that this is going to be position independent because you've subtracted off the center of mass. And similarly, there's a kind of rotation or sort of scale invariance that you can do by the normalization. And that's where it all starts. But what it leads up to is that you can also get some scale invariant moments. Okay, and there are six of these, of which I, five of these. I could have sworn there were six. Anyway, there's five listed right here. Okay, which are, take those moments from the previous page with the definition and by, and then there, here's the normalization right here. And it turns out that these are, So I've gotten a little bit confused right here. These are not the rotation invariant moments. These are just the scale invariant moments. There are six rotation invariant moments. They're coming up in just a second. Okay, these are just the scale invariant moments that we're going to want. So we've got the complex moments, these five complex moments based on the definition of the previous page. We're going to normalize them using the same normalization method that we looked at previously by dividing by the area. These gives us a set of scale invariant moments. There's five of them. And from those five, we can now define six rotation invariant moments. And these moments are all independent. There's no sort of redundancy in that set. There's a famous set of seven invariant moments defined about 20 years ago, but about 2 or 3 years ago, somebody discovered actually there's redundancy between those moments, and that you could develop the seventh one from some function of the other six. And as a consequence of that, they developed a new set that has only six moments in it that are independent of each other. Okay, so the six invariant moments, okay, are functions of all of these bit right here. Now, ignore all these extra numbers right in here at the moment. So they're just sort of the products of the various numbers right here, and you take either the real or the imaginary components of those. Okay, so those are the invariant moments. Now, as it turns out, when you each of these individual numbers is sort of between sort of 0 and 1, they're sort of small. And when you multiply lots of them together, they get smaller and smaller. Okay, and that's why we've got these sort of scaling factors out here. When you're working with numbers for description, it's always helpful if all of your descriptions have about the same range of value. Okay, it's just a kind of good engineering rule of thumb. And consequently, we've got these scaling factors in here to kind of bring the invariant numbers up to so that until they're all about the same sort of range. Okay, so that gives us a rotation invariance. We'll look at some MATLAB and some application of those just coming up on Tuesday next week. So anything, one last question here.
So this scale invariance moments,
yeah.
If you choose like a big U and V, does this like work if the image was translated half that distance, or do we have to match it right on?
No, all this scale invariance is independent of the position of the object and independent of the scale. As long as you can get the object fully in the image, in theory, these should be perfectly invariant. Because you have lens distortion and things like that, maybe if it gets to be too big or too close to the edges of the image, there may be some slight problems. But these invariants are really independent of position. And scale. Yeah. Okay. So see you next week.
Sorry, just a quick question. For master students and undergrad students to work in teams, is that recommended?
It's up to you. I think it's probably more convenient if people from the same year groups pair up, because your timetables will tend to be a bit similar, but it's not necessary. So it's up to you to find your team, but when it comes down to when I have to pair the students up themselves, I try to pair up masters and third years and visiting undergrads. just because your timetables tend to be convenient.
Okay.
And also, you know, sort of similar ages, similar interests, that kind of thing.
Sorry, just a quick question. How heavy on the processor would these calculations be?
Hang on a second. Sorry.
How heavy on a processor would these calculations be?
How quickly?
How heavy on the processor, as in, like, could you do these calculations on 30 frames a second, or would you have to reduce?
Yes, most of all of these, all these calculations are really trivial, I think. So,
okay.
Right. Never turned on the power. Good thing I didn't run out of my battery. Too late. I think a lot depends on how big your image is. You know,
yeah.
If you, you know, use a 10 megapixel camera or whatever, then you've got 10 times as many pixels to deal with. But roughly, this is linear in the number of pixels. Warren, Chris. So, because for thresholding and stuff like that, pretty much you do, you know, one operation for every pixel.
Yeah.
So. Yeah. Same for the moment calculations. You can do all of that on the fly as you sort of scan through the image. Yes. Chris, what's
just a mic amp here to the volume. Like
oh, right.
That was the problem last week.
Right. Oh, okay.
Excuse me, sir. Can I check my Pandora type?
Yeah.
Is it completed with my RTOR?
Yeah. Just email me and
okay.
I don't have my business. Just email me whichever group you want to get into. Really flexible. It's you know, you don't have to go, but the idea is to try, because there's so many students, I want to try to spread them all the time. I just want to try to spread people. Yep. Yeah, when you're in the midst of a lecture, you don't have time to fuss around with all sorts of stuff.
No, yes.
Anyway, thanks. You have a contract to sign for me, don't you?
I just sent you an email about what I can do, yeah.
Okay.